Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly report on the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, our hopes about the future for our kids, everything that shapes the economic dimensions of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write columns, particularly for truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day. Check them out at truthout.org. We maintain two websites that I want to mention to you, because if you're interested in this program and the kinds of work we do, these websites, available to you at no charge 24/7, may be something you want to look into. We certainly hope you will. The first is called rdwolf, with two Fs, .com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Not only will you get more of the kinds of analysis we do on this program, but you'll get interviews on the media that I do, lectures, entire classes, in a range of subjects I think you will find interesting. Two more things are available on both of these websites that I would recommend. First, both of them provide you a way to communicate to us, to let us know what you like and don't like about the program, what you would like to see us do, what kinds of questions you'd like us to respond to. The last 10 minutes or so of every program are devoted to responding to your questions, but we read them all and we use them to shape the material on this program. And finally, both websites allow you to click on an icon, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and follow us in that way to be kept up to date on a more ongoing way with all of the different things that we are doing. So let's turn now in July to the updates for today. During the last week, perhaps the most important update was an agreement between the United States government and Citibank of New York, one of the largest banks in the United States, or indeed the world, in which Citibank agreed to pay in the neighborhood of $7 billion, with a B, for various misdeeds that it is guilty of, having to do with the mortgage crisis that basically crashed both the American and indeed the world economy back in 2008. And I want to talk a little bit about this. These numbers are large. In addition to what Citibank has already agreed to pay, Bank of America is in very similar negotiations, and indeed, by the time you hear this program, they may have come to an agreement in the same neighborhood of around $7 billion, we're told, for their misdeeds and the misdeeds of subsidiaries. Now, what is going on here is something I've discussed with you before. The major banks in the United States, what we sometimes call the money center banks, have now been accused. Evidence has been brought. Guilty has been clearly acknowledged by the enormity of the fines that they're paying, at least enormous by standards historically, even though not so enormous by standards of the business these companies are doing. And here's just a partial list of what they have admitted to and paid fines for. Money laundering, that is, knowingly taking money from criminal enterprises, running them through the banking system so that they can be used by these criminals without being traced back to the criminal activity out of which they arose. Money laundering, we call that. Number two, they have been accused and found to have overcharged customers, from the consumer on the street to corporations, for financial services. Number three, they have engaged in illegal conspiracies to control and manipulate interest rates, the so-called LIBOR scandal that was much in the news a few months back, in which they connived to set interest rates that would enhance their well-being, even though it cost people around the world who pay interest on everything from homes and cars to credit cards an enormous amount of money. And now the really big one, having manipulated the mortgage market, having deceived people who took out mortgages about what it would cost and what risks were involved, having mishandled the mortgage process, having then mishandled when the mortgages went bad, and so on. So we have a list of misdeeds involving trillions of dollars touching every person on the planet one way or another, performed by these big banks. At the height of the crisis in 2008 and 2009, they were accused of being too big to fail. That is, we couldn't do anything about them because they were so big that if the government really went after them and they fell apart because of all the bad things they'd done, well, then they'd take the whole economy down with them. And this was considered to be so dangerous that it was simply impossible to allow this to happen. And so then the government bailed them out rather than doing anything to make them fail and pay, in a sense, for all of the damage they had caused. And, by the way, one last point, they were bankrupt, all of them. They had made terrible investments. They got caught holding the bag. So in addition to all their criminal, illegal, immoral activities, they had not carried out their banking function successfully because their banks were kaput, were finished. And the government came in with trillions of dollars, a good bit of it our money, taxpayer money, and bailed them out. This is a record of failure and misbehavior that calls into question whether they ought to be allowed to exist. If we were a rational economy that functioned in a reasonable way, we wouldn't be interested in throwing a few billion dollars of penalties at them any more than we would be interested in taking a few of their top officers and prosecuting them and putting them in jail. Whatever temporary satisfaction that gives, it doesn't solve the problem. The people we put in jail will be replaced by their underlings who will be working in the same system, subject to the same rewards and punishments, and they'll end up doing the same. That's been the history. Likewise, these penalties, however large they may sound on the headline, are small potatoes compared to the amount of money these enterprises deal with. And so it hasn't in the past stopped them from doing this. It isn't going to in the future. This is a problem of our banking system. And unless you transform the system, you're not dealing significantly with this problem. It is amazing that our country permits these dysfunctional enterprises to continue to remain private enterprises seeking to make money, no matter what the damage socially they cause. What are the solutions? That's not a hard guess, is it? First of all, public banks. Governments everywhere ought to do what the state of North Dakota has been doing for 100 years, operating a public bank owned and operated by the public in the interest of the public, where all the money that the government gets, taxes, fees, is deposited in their own bank with the loans made with that money to local people and local businesses to support the local economy. Just as important, banks need to be made into community enterprises. Since the community depends on the bank, since we all depend on credit more than we ever have, we ought to have this enterprise, credit distributing loans, handled socially in a responsible way that we can all discuss and debate, that are transparent, where we can vote on what we want the banks to do rather than have them dysfunctionally threaten us every few years by major collapses. It's a scandal, nothing short of it, to have this kind of performance and to have no responsible public official, almost none, say something publicly about how if any public enterprise worked that badly, you'd know there'd be calls to privatize. But we don't seem to be able to say when a private industry, privatized industry like banking, does such damage, such behavior, illegal, immoral, and economically and socially destructive, we can't even discuss public banking. We can't even discuss converting banks into co-ops, in which the workers and the customers of the bank together decide what is needed with the local political authorities. That's what we ought to do. It's a shame that we don't. Another update is a short one. It has to do with a quite well-known comedian, Tracy Morgan, famous from the television program 30 Rock and other programs that he has enlivened with his comedic art and skill. He was involved in a terrible automobile accident very short time ago. It killed well-known comedian riding with him, and it caused very serious injuries to Tracy Morgan himself, and he is slowly recovering from those injuries. The police charged the driver of a van that came up behind the car Tracy Morgan was in and rear-ended him. And as you, many of you know, that's always the fault of the person who's not driving carefully enough and who doesn't avoid rear-ending somebody else. But Tracy Morgan is doing something very interesting that I want to bring to your attention. He is suing the corporation that owned and operated the van driven by the man that the police have charged. That corporation is Walmart. And it turns out that this person driving the car was very tired. And one of the reasons he was tired was the policies of Walmart that effectively lead their drivers often to work 24 hours in a row. Well, you don't need to be a medical doctor to know that if you're working 24 hours in a row or anything like it, you become tired, too tired to drive properly. And what Tracy Morgan is doing is being very responsible. He wants to go to the root of the problem. The root of the problem is not the behavior of that driver. That's being taken care of as a criminal matter. If he's culpable, he will have his day in court. He will be treated for the degree of responsibility he has. What is often overlooked is the responsibility of the employer who puts people like that in harm's way and puts all the rest of us in harm's way as a result. It's a very important step that Tracy Morgan is taking. I want to applaud it by saying he wants to go after the work conditions imposed by employers that can have such terrible results. Staying with that same thing right for a moment, I want to talk about another event that happened over the last week. The United States House of Representatives, with now apparently the agreement of the Senate and the President, decided not to put more money into the highway fund that runs the federally maintained highway system of the United States. And the New York Times, on the 15th of July, ran an editorial that contained a couple of facts I want to also underline. The editorial begins that 10,000 motorists die each year because of inadequate road conditions. Wow. And that doesn't speak about the millions of Americans caught in unnecessary traffic jams and delays on countless roads because they're not wide enough, they're not maintained enough, they're impeded by construction, and so on. Well, the Highway Trust Fund is the money that Congress contributes to do a better job than has been done. It depends, and here comes the key economics of it, it depends on a gasoline tax. For those of you that are not familiar, the gasoline tax in the United States, the federal tax that funds the Highway Trust Fund, has been stuck at 18.4 cents per gallon since 1993. It hasn't been raised, which means the sheer increase of prices each year has eroded 39% of the value of that tax because, you know, you're raising the same amount of money, but you're not paying the higher prices that have to be paid for in everything having to do with maintaining or improving your roads. What the Congress couldn't agree on was to give the government the right to raise the gasoline tax, to raise it from 18.4 cents a gallon to a larger amount, thereby pouring money into the Highway Trust Fund and thereby doing a better job of maintaining our roads and saving lives. And the liberals across the United States, including the New York Times in that editorial, argues in favor of raising the gas tax. Well, I support the notion of maintaining our highways. I support the idea that that is a crucial part of our society where everything we buy depends on arriving in a truck at the store where we buy it, where all of us depend on automobiles in countless ways I can't even list. Obviously, so long as we're dependent on the car and the truck, we need a highway system that is maintained. It is irrational to do what we are doing in this society. but I would strongly oppose solving this problem by raising the gasoline tax. The argument of the liberals seems to be that the gasoline tax should be raised because, quote, it makes people using the highway pay more for it. Here's my opposition. The people who benefit from a highway are not just the people who drive in a car or a truck. It's all the rest of us as well. The highway is a social institution. It shouldn't be paid for by the particular people who drive on it. Why don't we require it to be paid for by all of us that are convenienced by being able to go to a local store to buy the things we need when the only way the local store ever gets those things is because a car or more likely a truck or a van brought it there? And the same applies to our jobs, which could not be what they are without public transportation on highways and so on. We all benefit. And the way to support the highways is to tax, and to tax those most able to pay, the way our federal income tax is structured. That would be the logical way. That would be the fair way. Not just to tax those who happen to be the ones who are driving. It's as if we funded the police by making everybody pay for how many police hours they might like, or we made people pay for the fire protection, or we made individuals pay for their school, more or less, depending on where you lived, and so on. Public fire, public police, public education, public military, and countless other services that we all benefit from are paid for by taxes in general. And that's the way we ought to handle this as well. Next update that we have time for, the city of Southampton. I want to talk to you a little bit about that. The city of Southampton is part of what are called the Hamptons, a very, very wealthy a group of communities at the far end of Long Island, a suburb of New York City, famous because it has houses that go for up to $100 million each, beautiful views of the ocean out there, and so on. And so it's considered a town of the wealthy. But I think it's an emblem of what the United States has become. And so my eyes were opened when an attentive listen to this program, sent me a story. It was actually a story done by the Associated Press, but carried in the Times Union, the newspaper of Albany, New York. And what it points out is that what's little known about the Long Island Hamptons, and in this case, Southampton in particular, with stories about Southampton, is that there are many thousands of people there who have no money. That is, they're not rich. They're the people who maintain the lawns, the driveways, clean the houses, work in the local hospital, the folks who do the work that people don't pay much attention to, and that isn't as glitzy or newsworthy as what the rich and famous are doing as they play in that part. So expensive have these towns become that all of these sorts of working people can't afford to live there. They have to live elsewhere in Long Island, typically 1 or 2 hours away from these Hamptons, therefore imposing on them hours and hours of commuting, which they can barely afford and which takes much of their time, to get to these jobs. And the jobs are only seasonal because other than in the summer, many, many fewer of these people are there and they use less of these services. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of them. And what the story revealed, by the way, it appeared in the Times Union of Albany on Saturday, July 12th. What it shows is that we pay attention in the United States to the rich and famous, who are in fact a tiny minority. And we tend to ignore all of the people who depend on them, because if some people become wildly rich, more and more other people are hired by them to be, in effect, personal servants of one kind or another. And that's what Southampton shows so dramatically. That's what the Hamptons show so dramatically. A country that isn't anymore what it might once have claimed to be, a place where at least a large portion of its people are close enough in income that they interact with one another as individual free people. Unlike the Southamptons of this world, where we're beginning to have all of the signs of a society that has crumbled into a handful of obscenely rich folks, served by an increasingly stressed society, and encumbered mass of people who are little more than their servants. This is a very dangerous and socially divisive kind of economic development that ought to be a lot more concern to folks than it tends to get in the way of public attention. Okay, so let me then turn to some of the bigger issues we're going to be dealing with in our program today. And the way for me to start is to talk about worker self-directed enterprises. Now, this is something that I talk about from time to time, and I'm gratified to see so many of you are interested in that topic. So let's talk about it a little bit. A worker self-directed enterprise, or what is sometimes called a worker co-op, is an enterprise that is radically differently organized from the conventional capitalist enterprise. In the latter, we have the people who own it, the shareholders. And if you know something about shareholding in the United States, most companies that have shareholders have the following situation. A tiny group of the shareholders, 1% of them, control 3/4 of the shares. In other words, shares are not equally distributed in our society. Shares are extremely unequally distributed. A tiny number of what get called major shareholders have the dominant number of shares. Why is that important? Well, if you own the majority of shares, it means you have the majority of votes, because it's one share, one vote, when it comes to selecting the board of directors. The board of directors, in every corporation is a group of 10 to 20 people who make all the basic decisions. What to produce, how to produce, where to produce, what to do with the profits. All of that is made by this tiny group of people selected by an even tinier group of people, the major shareholders. That's how they run. Everybody else is an order taker. Everybody else, in business terms, is a drone, a person who's hired, comes to work, and goes home, who is excluded systematically from all of the key decisions. What to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. All the workers share the job of producing those profits, but they are excluded from deciding what to do with what their labor helped to produce. It is, therefore, the opposite of democracy. So a WSDE, a worker self-directed enterprise, is precisely a differently organized enterprise. In a WSDE, all of the workers together, collectively, democratically, make the decisions. They decide together what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. The idea is simple. If you work someplace, if you depend on that job, if your brains and muscle help to develop whatever that company produces and whatever profits it earns, then you have the right to participate in deciding the decisions that are crucial about this enterprise. It applies to the workplace exactly the same democratic principles we claim as a nation to apply to our communities. If you live in a community, if you depend on a community, if you help to pay for a community with your taxes, etc., well, then you ought to be a full democratic participant in all of the decisions that affect your community. If that applies to the community, then we would argue it ought to apply, ought long ago to have applied, to our workplaces. Okay. Have there been workplaces organized this way? Absolutely, all through history. We have them all around the United States, and we have them around the world. There have been places where workers have gotten together and organized their own worker cooperative to work this way, to bring democracy to the workplace, to democratize the economy, if you want to use another way of saying this. And this has been very controversial. Basically, it's been controversial because capitalist enterprises, owned and operated by a tiny group of shareholders who have the power to select and therefore control the board of directors, they don't want cooperative enterprises because the development of a cooperative enterprise is a direct threat to their undemocratic power and control and wealth in the conventionally organized capitalist enterprises. So there's a controversy about a co-op because it is so different an enterprise from what has become normal, if you like, in capitalism. But people have wanted them. People have been upset and angry about the absence of them. So we have a co-op movement all around the world. Questions have been raised, and that's what I want to get to. Can a co-op be successful? The idea here being, look, a conventional capitalist enterprise has a hierarchy. There's the boss at the top who gives orders to the folks in the middle who give orders to everybody below. And the idea is frequently heard, well, you can't get much done if we all have to discuss it and we all have to vote on it. It kind of can't be a workable arrangement. And if we don't have the profit motive driving us, well, we won't be efficient, we won't be modernizing, et cetera, et cetera. And I want to show you how and why those arguments are wrong. First of all, the empirical record. Co-ops are just as successful over time and in a wide variety of circumstances as non-co-ops. So the idea that if you see a co-op, well, you're going to watch it flop, that's simply not true. So the empirical record is crystal clear. I like to use, there are many examples, but I like to use two. One is the Arizmendi bakeries in California, in the Bay Area, who've gone from one to half a dozen bakeries scattered around that area over the last 20 or 30 years, successful, growing, expanding. They work like a worker self-directed enterprises where the workers are their own bosses, a co-op. But perhaps the most famous is that factory business, that holding company, that immense success, Mondragon in the north of Spain. Starting with six workers in 1956, it now employs in the neighborhood of 80 or 90,000 people. It's the seventh biggest corporation in all of Spain. It is a family of over 100 co-ops that help each other, every one of which is organized as a workers' co-op. Did it succeed over the 50 years? You bet. Did it grow? Spectacularly. Was it competing with conventional capitalist enterprises all the way? Yes. Did it outcompete them? You betcha. In other words, the record is clear. But we shouldn't be surprised that the empirical record demonstrates that worker co-ops are viable institutions. By the way, do some of them fail? Of course. But some of every kind of enterprise fails. The number of capitalist enterprises going out of business every year in the United States, for example, is measured in the many thousands. Well, what are the reasons, theoretically? The answer here is not far to check. In a capitalist enterprise, you have to sell whatever you produce at a price high enough to pay for all the materials you used, all the machines and equipment you needed, all the workers you had to pay. So all the costs plus paying profits, dividends, to people who don't work there, who are owners and so forth. And you pay an enormous amount to high-priced executive managers. If you're a worker self-directed enterprise, you don't pay profits to anybody else. You don't have to raise your prices to cover payment of profits and dividends to shareholders. You have lower costs. But that's only the beginning. If you're a workers' collectively self-directed enterprise, everybody's part of the business. Everybody has an interest in making the business more efficient. You celebrate everybody's help in figuring out how to save a little over here, how to get a little more out of that machine, how to do this. Everybody's the beneficiary. In a conventional capitalist firm, if a worker does something more efficient, it may help the bottom line, it may help the profits, but that worker doesn't see those profits. That worker doesn't participate in deciding what to do with the profits he's enhanced by his improvement. So there's less of an incentive for workers in a capitalist enterprise because they have no skin in the game. They're not part of the ownership and operation of the enterprise, and that makes an enormous difference in the efficiency and the technical growth of an enterprise. So for those reasons alone, we are not surprised that the empirical record shows that workers' self-directed enterprises often are just as efficient or more efficient, just as technologically advanced or more technically advanced than their capitalist counterparts. The notion that a co-op business can't succeed or work is an idea that's comfortable and pleasing to the old capitalist enterprise operators who fear the competition that they pretend not to fear. We've come to the halfway part of this program. We're going to take a very short break, and we'll be right back. Please join us.
Well, I feel so low.
Welcome back. This is Richard Wolff, and the program is Economic Update. As always, I want to remind you that if this program is of interest and you find what we do worth pursuing, we maintain two websites where you can do that at your leisure, 24/7, at no charge whatsoever. The first one is called rdwolff.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. In addition to the lectures and media interviews and classes and interviews of all kinds that you will find there to pursue your interests, you will also be able to communicate with us via email, telling us what you'd like us to cover, what interests you, what you don't like about the program. And we make great use of that in designing these programs, so we encourage you to take advantage of that. And likewise, on both those websites, you can click on the icons for Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest and follow us on a more regular basis that way. Before the break, we were talking about worker self-directed enterprises, and I want to spend just a little bit more time on those so that we can make a few more contributions around questions that you have sent me. Some of you wanted to know how a worker self-directed enterprise would function if it worked in a market system. In other words, if a worker self-directed enterprise sold its outputs as commodities in a market, if it bought its inputs as commodities in a market. And I will answer that, but before I do, I want to make clear that markets are not the only way to distribute goods. They are not the only way to get an input or to distribute an output to a final consumer. The human race has exhibited in the past and does today all kinds of other ways to distribute goods and services. For example, we do not distribute, as I've made the point earlier today, we do not distribute police services that way. We do not say, you want a cop? Here, pay per hour for a policeman. We don't do that. And we don't ask you to pay per hour of a fireman or a firefighter. And we don't do that in our public school system. And we don't do that in our military security system. And we don't do that, see the point? We distribute police, fire, educational services, but not in a quid pro quo, I'll give you so much, you give me the money. We don't do that. We provide those in a socially planned way. rather than a market way. Let me give you a second example. It's one I like to use often. When you gather with your family, say for a Thanksgiving dinner, do you distribute in a market way? For example, if mother bakes the turkey, roasts it, and then she distributes to everybody else sitting at the table the pieces of the turkey that comprise your meal, does she use a market system? In other words, do you have to shell out $6 to get a turkey drumstick? No, of course not. When at the end of the meal, one of your relatives asks you to take out the plates and clean them off and take care of the end of the meal cleanup, do you say, sure, but that'll be X dollars to have me do this service? In other words, do we use a market inside the household and the family to distribute the goods and services each of us produces to the other people who consume them? No is the answer. Very few families work that way. Most families would think that was a horrible intrusion of the outside world's rules of marketing inside a family. They would say, no. We love each other in this family. We like to do things for one another. We don't want to have money intrude in here. We don't want there to be a market in the things we do for one another. That's done out of love, affection, solidarity, and so on. In other words, there's lots of production right now in the world, right now here in the United States or any other country, that is production of goods that find their way to other people who are the consumers, but there's no market that's making that happen. No market exchange. I'll give you so much of this for so much of that. So if we had worker self-directed enterprises, they might organize a system of distribution that was a non-market system, which we have often had in the past and the present. But even if they used a market system, that's an arrangement. Every other way of organizing production has examples when they used a market and when they didn't. For example, in ancient slave societies, sometimes there were markets for whatever the slaves produced. Sometimes there were markets for the slaves themselves, since they're property. But there were also slave systems that didn't have markets, that distributed goods in another way. The same is true of feudal manors, of plantations, of self-employed people who interacted with one another, but not by buying and selling from one another. So in all systems of production, ways of organizing production, including worker self-directed enterprises, there are examples when markets were used, and there are examples when they weren't. And most societies, like our own, mix some market with some non-market. The celebration of the market, as if it's the greatest invention since sliced bread, is a bit of an example of ignorance. We've never had a system relying entirely on markets. We don't have one now. It is a fantasy construction any more than we probably will be able to ever do without markets altogether. We'll have some places where we think they work and other places where we think they don't, and we substitute something else. The creative human mind has always done that. It would be bizarre to imagine that it didn't. And worker self-directed enterprises are just as capable as any other institution of figuring out what mix of markets and non-markets they want, what kinds of controls and limits they want to put on the portion of their economy that they do organize in markets, and so on. The next major issue has to do with extreme wealth. I return to this because so many of you communicate to me that you want to know more about that. Okay, well, perhaps the most stunning statistic to come out of the world of journalism and economics over the last 6 months was a report earlier this year by Oxfam International. It is a very well-known international poverty-fighting organization. And they made news at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, earlier this year, when they presented a statistical finding. And their finding was the following, that the 85, count them, the 85 richest people, individuals, in the world today, own assets, that is, they own property, land, buildings, stocks, bonds, equal in value to the total wealth owned by the poorer half of the world's population. Now, let me make sure that that's really clear to everyone. The 85 richest people own as much wealth as the 3.5 billion poor half of the population of this planet. Both groups, the 3.5 billion poorest half of our fellow citizens of the world, own 1.7 trillion in wealth. That's what they own, 3.5 billion people. The 85 richest individuals also own $1.7 trillion. That is as grotesque a difference as we would have to search back to Egyptian pharaohs, to wildly rich emperors centuries ago, to see anything like this. The 85 richest people have as much wealth as the 3.5 billion poorest people, half the population of the globe. What can you say about this? Well, it's an indictment of capitalism. Capitalism is the system of the last 200 to 300 years that has created every one of those 85 people. They are the ones who've risen to the top in the capitalist system by a mixture of skill and luck, which any of them, if they were honest, and some of them are, would admit. They're the ones sitting at the top of the system gave them their opportunity. The system gave them the chance to accumulate. Capitalism is itself to be judged and evaluated by the fact that it has produced a situation in which the 85 richest people have the same wealth as is shared by 3.5 billion poor people. There's really not much more to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. Out of the 85, approximately 8 have made a commitment, actually signed a pledge, promising to leave, quote unquote, a majority of their wealth to philanthropy. Simple English, 10% of these super rich people are going to give away a large part of their money. Of course, who they give it to, they decide. Who benefits from their wealth, they decide. Anyone who studies these folks knows that they sit at the top of economic empires in which millions of people contribute directly and indirectly to producing the wealth that they own. They didn't do it by themselves. They did it at the top of huge corporations. Berkshire Hathaway for Warren Buffett, Microsoft for Bill Gates, and so on. So millions of people produce the wealth that they have. They decide what to do with it. They decide whether they keep it for themselves and give it to their children. They decide whether to give it to philanthropy, and then they decide what philanthropy they like. This is the most undemocratic way to handle the wealth of an economic system that I could imagine. That's why I take us back to ancient Pharaoh Egypt or empires long dead, when you had, again, huge societies of people working the fields, raising the animals, building the castles, where a tiny group of people consumed and lived in all of that wealth. The grotesque unfairness of it, by the way, always eventuating, even if it took a long time, in revolutionary rages. We have a situation then in which we have a system that is the opposite of democratic. Everybody helps to produce the wealth, but a tiny number of people draw it into their hands and then do with it as they like, a kind of flaunting of your obscene and extreme wealth in the face of a society that is so needy. It's an extraordinary study in what a society can come to accept as somehow normal, reasonable, even though it screams from the history of the world its unfair, unjust, and undemocratic nature and consequences. Over the last couple of weeks, Forbes magazine, a magazine by and for corporate executives and wealthy people, has been talking about all of this and giving more details. They have no great criticism to offer. They just want to talk about whether the rich are getting larger in number or smaller, whether it takes $20 or $30 billion to be on the list of the richest, and so forth and so on. They are interested in such distinctions as self-made versus inherited. They point out that 40% of these super rich folks inherited the money. So there, no claim can be made that they did anything other than marry well or be born, something about which you really don't have all that much to say. And they're very happy that 60% are self-made. The word self-made is wonderful. It doesn't really mean that you made those billions of dollars, because what sense would that make? The billions of dollars accumulated by Microsoft were the result of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people's efforts, of education of all kinds of people, of technical breakthroughs made by all kinds of people, employees of Microsoft in other companies that Microsoft bought, in other companies that or academic situations where a paper was written that proved useful years later. The number of people contributing is enormous, but the number of billionaires can be collected in one small room. Something's wrong in this picture. It's one thing to reward a person who makes a breakthrough, to recognize a person who sees something. By all means, recognize them. But we're not talking about recognizing one among many who makes a breakthrough. We're talking about giving one person, in perpetuity, a wildly disproportionate amount of what many people help to produce. What's the logic? What's the justice of that? And how could it possibly coexist in a system that wants to call itself democratic? Let me turn now, finally, to some of your questions and comments that I find to be wonderful lessons to me about what it is I ought to do on this program. One of you asks, isn't it reasonable that when wages go up, prices go up too? And the answer is, no, it's not reasonable. And let me tell you why. The price of something depends on many, many, many things. It depends on the costs of the materials. It depends on the costs and the efficiency of the machinery. It depends on the cost and the efficiency of the building or the location where production occurs. It depends on how workers work. It depends on how managers manage. It depends on how many people want whatever it is that's being produced and how much they're willing to pay. All of those factors go into determining the price. If the wage you pay a worker goes up, that is occurring at the same time that all of those other conditions are likewise changing, typically some going up and some going down, some pushing the price up and some pushing the price down. A business that raises a price and claims that it is doing that and points the finger at wages is almost always looking for a public relations excuse. They don't want to say they're raising the price because their efficiency has gone down. They don't want to say they're raising the price because they can see an eager public and this is a chance to squeeze some more money out of the buyers. They don't want to say that. They don't even want to look like they're thinking it. They want their increase in prices, whatever the real reason might be, to appear to be something forced on them by the workers they hire because they have to pay them higher wages. This is not to be taken seriously. Most of the time, it isn't even true, not even a little bit. But it's never the whole story. Many times, prices are raised because the company wants to make more profits. After all, that's how they're judged. Are you a successful company? Are your profits going up? Should one buy shares in your company? Are your profits going up? There's enormous pressure on the people who run our corporations to make more profits. And one of the nicest, cleanest, quickest ways of doing that is to raise the price. So, but you don't want to be blamed when you raise the price for doing exactly what you're doing, which is looking for a way to make more profits, and in this case, squeezing more money out of your customers. Instead, you want to raise your shoulders and say, what can I do? The wages went up. Don't be fooled. And by the way, when you ask workers why they are pushing to have their wages up, they will often say, correctly, that that's because the prices they have to pay have gone up. But just as with prices, workers, of course, have many reasons to want higher wages. They want to live a more comfortable life. They want to provide the American dream to their kids. They have all kinds of motivations, not just the prices they pay. But this is a game, folks, in which what you do when you're worried, if you're honest about why you do it, can be covered over by claiming you're not doing it because you want something, but because it's forced on you by somebody else. Price increases in our society have many, many causes. Increasing wages is at best one of many, and most of the time a pretty lame excuse for a price increase that has many, many other causes. The last question you sent in, for which we'll have time, has to do with the economic effects of solar power, wind power, and green energy in general, different from relying on oil and gas and coal. Well, let's do a little history because it'll help us answer this question. Once upon a time, not that long ago, in the early phases of capitalism, a couple hundred years ago, and even as little as 100 years ago, an enormous amount of our energy was provided by coal. Why coal? Well, because mostly it was available, and businesses found profitable ways to mine the coal and sell it to the rest of us to power our businesses, to heat our homes, etc. Well, then a transition, starting 100 or so years ago, a little earlier, and continuing for quite a while, even until the present, there was a transition, you might say, from coal to oil and gas. Again, why did that? Was there a big national discussion that we shouldn't have coal and that we should have oil and gas? Not at all. Or if there was such a discussion, it was peripheral and tangential to the decision. It became profitable. Companies developed, the Rockefellers, for example, that found ways to make the production of oil profitable. They got the government to subsidize a lot of it. They used every kind of tactic, legal and illegal, to make a profit. And so if they were able to be profitable with oil, they began to build up the oil business where their profits were concerned. And they struggled against the coal operators who didn't want to lose the profits of their. But it was a struggle between capitalists that determined what kind of energy we had. The first time we began to think about energy, not as something to be decided for us by the struggle among capitalists, but actually to be decided by us based on a rational conversation, was when we began to get nervous about nuclear power, when nuclear accidents and nuclear meltdowns and the horror of the nuclear bomb made us begin to say, wait a minute, even if it's profitable for some capitalist to go into nuclear energy, we maybe don't want that. This is the beginning of a very healthy development where social debate about the social impact of an energy is being brought into the discussion, so we're not all left with the results of whatever the profit-making capitalists end up being able to do or not being able to do. The same then applies today. We ought to have, we are having, a national conversation about the benefits of solar, of green energy of all kinds, wind power, all the rest of it. That's very healthy. The decision about energy should be made based on all of the factors we can count in, of which profitability is only one and far from the main one. That's an impressive step forward. My fear is that whether it's the Koch brothers or anybody else, there are lots of capitalists still involved in the energy business, Lord knows, who are going to do everything in their power, as has always been the case, to make profit, and their ability to keep going as profit, decide what energy we live with or die from. And anything that breaks that stranglehold, that opens up the decision, not just about energy, but about everything else, so it can be democratic, that we can all participate, that's the issue. No one knows in advance whether the transition to wind and solar and green will in the end cost a little more or a little less than relying on nuclear oil and gas. But is that really the issue, how much it costs? No. The issue is the social meaning of all of this. And having a conversation go in that direction is a contribution that environmentalists are making to a broad rethinking of how we make economic decisions. Thank you very much for your attention. We've come to the end of the program. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, looking forward to meeting with you again next week.
My time, my time, babe. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.